find your way there. When you find it, kind of put one finger there and then go to Psalm 119, if you would. Psalm 25, and then over to Psalm 119. Let me ask you a few trivia questions to begin with this morning. What's the longest chapter in the Bible? Psalm 119. All right. How many verses are there? 3,000, I heard. What'd you say, Ted? I think Ted had it. 176. All right. What else do you notice different about this psalm than other psalms? There are separations, and each division has this weird word in front of it, right? What are those words? The letters of the Hebrew alphabet, right? There are 22 divisions to Psalm 176. Each of them, the heading is the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. The Hebrew alphabet has 22 letters. Each of these headings is the letter of the alphabet in order. Each division has 8 verses. For instance, if you look at Psalm 119, verse 1, you see the first 8 verses form a division centered around the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Now, two other things about the Psalm 119. The first word in each of those 8 verses begins with that letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So suppose it's like in English, A is our first letter of our alphabet. Verses 1 to 8, each verse, the first word of the verse, begins with the letter A. Verses 9 through 16, if it was in English, eight verses would begin with the letter what? B. The next 8 verses would all begin with the letter C. It's perfectly done that way, I understand it. I'm not a Hebrew scholar. Throughout the entire psalm. All right, there's one other thing about Psalm 119. Almost without exception, I think there's maybe one or two exceptions out of the 176 verses, but almost without exception, each verse will name the scriptures in some way. There's 7 or 8 different words that are used, but each verse, almost without fail, will have one of those names for the Word of God. Let's kind of look and see. Verse 1. Blessed are the undefiled in the way who walk in the law of the Lord. What word there is it? Law. The law of the Lord, or the word of the Lord. Verse 2, blessed are those who keep his testimonies, who seek him with the whole heart. Which word? Testimonies. Verse 3, they also do no iniquity, they walk in his ways. Ways. Verse 4, you have commanded us to keep your precepts diligently. Precepts. And you can go on down. Verse 5 is statutes. Verse 6, commandments. Verse 7, judgments. Verse 8, statutes. Verse 9, word. Verse 10, commandments. Verse 11, word. And you can go on down through the entire psalm. Psalm 119 is unique in a number of ways. Those are those. But the reason I bring that to your attention is because back over in Psalm 125, how many verses do you see in this psalm? 22 verses in Psalm 25. How many letters of the Greek alphabet are there, or the Hebrew alphabet? 22. All right? That gives you an idea this may be one of those acrostic psalms, and it is, with one or two exceptions, that last verse being one of them. But it's not a complete acrostic, but it is a very similar to one, or almost one. You see, on the outline, I've got a list of the psalms that are acrostic, written as acrostic in the scripture. Psalm 9 and 10 go together to make an acrostic. Chapter 25, 34, 37, 111, 112, 119, 145. I'm not sure if those are, I think a lot of those are not complete acrostics, but they are portions of it. Okay, so that's an interesting kind of side note as we begin this psalm, Psalm 25, written as an acrostic, probably the most second complete one of that group that we listed. You see, I've got the message entitled, After a Few Trips Around the Block. You've heard someone say, and I've said this before, this is not my first trip around the block. Someone makes a statement similar to that. What do they mean by that? Been there, done that. What did you say, Stephen? Experience. Okay. Thank you, Ted. Ted has a way of putting things, doesn't he? All right, seen the elephant, heard the owl cry, and what was the rest of that?
Seen the elephant, heard the owl cry.
Seen the elephant, heard the owl cry. That's experience. All right, so when we say that phrase, I've been around the block a few times, it means that we have a little experience. We know something about the subject matter at hand. Another statement similar to that, this is not my first rodeo. That's the redneck version, I suppose, of that statement. As I read Psalm 25 and read it a number of times over and over, and pretty quickly there came to my mind that this psalm was written by someone who had been around the block a few times. Someone who had walked with the Lord, not just a year or two, but for years. Someone who has had fellowship with the Lord and with God for a long time. Even though the psalm gives us a number of petitions that the psalmists make to God, God lead me, God guide me, God teach me, God don't remember my trespasses and all these things. Even though he's asking God for a lot of things, it just comes across, if you read it enough, as someone who has been there. And I want to point out five or six things from the psalm about a person who has been around the block. All right, let's read the psalm. Psalm 25. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you. Let me not be ashamed. Let not my enemies triumph over me. Does anybody know the song that comes from that? Unto thee, O Lord, do I lift up my voice. Anybody know that song? I started to bring it this morning and sing that, but I didn't do it. Verse 3, indeed, let no one who waits on you be ashamed. Let those be ashamed who deal treacherously without cause. Show me your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. There's another song. Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. On you I wait all the day. Remember, O Lord, your tender mercies and your loving kindness, for they are from of old. Do not remember the sins of my youth nor my transgressions. According to your mercy, remember me, for your goodness' sake, O Lord. Good and upright is the Lord, therefore he teaches sinners in the way. The humble he guides in justice, and the humble he teaches his way. All the paths of the Lord are mercy and truth to such as keep his covenant and his testimonies. For your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my iniquity, for it is great. Who is the man that fears the Lord? Him shall he teach in the way he chooses. He himself shall dwell in prosperity, and his descendants shall inherit the earth. The secret of the Lord is with those who fear him, and he will show them his covenant. My eyes are ever toward the Lord, for he shall pluck my feet out of the net. Turn yourself to me and have mercy on me, for I am desolate and afflicted. The troubles of my heart have enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses. Look on my affliction and my pain, and forgive all my sins. Consider my enemies, for they are many, and they hate me with cruel hatred. Keep my soul and deliver me. Let me not be ashamed, for I put my trust in you. Let integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. Redeem, O Israel, O God, or redeem Israel, O God, out of all their troubles. The first point I want to make from the first three verses is this. Those who've been around the block are not easily disappointed in God. See in verse 1 and 3, the word ashamed, and this is an interesting word. This is an English word that we use, but over the years, this word has lost part of its meaning. The only way, pretty much, that we use this word ashamed is to be embarrassed or to be humiliated. And that's not what it means here. It means disappointed. The psalmist is saying, O God, I have put my trust in you. I lift up my soul to you, O God. I have lifted it up, and I have put my trust in you. Don't disappoint me. And the idea is that the psalmist has learned, even though he makes the petition to God, he has learned that putting your trust in God, you can put your trust in God, that God will not disappoint you. Even though our lives will be speckled and sprinkled with hardship, if you live long enough, and most of us don't have to live very long, there are hardships that come. Some of them we would label as tragedies, catastrophes, some just discomfort. They fill our lives. Our lives are sprinkled throughout with these. But this psalmist has learned that he can still put his trust in God. God will not disappoint. Number two, the statement there is you really can teach an old dog new tricks. You really can. The psalmist is experienced. The psalmist has been around the block. The psalmist has walked with God, and yet what does he still say in verse 4? God, show me. I want to make a statement that you may want to challenge, and that's okay. But I've been around the block a few times too, you know. The older we get, the less, generally speaking, human beings can be taught. Our minds become set. Our minds become fixed. I remember when I was a kid, a small kid, 5 or 6, well, probably 4 or 5 years old, because it was in my grandparents' old house, and they had a little wooden plaque on the wall, and I never really understood that plaque until I got grown. But here's what it said. It's what you learn after you know it all that counts. Isn't that true? There are a lot of people, maybe including me, that there are just some things I think I got figured out. And don't bother me with facts or new ideas or anything like that. I just now thought of this. Daniel sent me something a while back on a text, and I don't remember what it said now, but it stung just a little bit. Do you remember what that was? Something about, you know, you're getting old when... Something like when new ideas, you dread new ideas or something, you know you're getting old or something. I can't remember. Well, I figured that out. That wasn't, I wasn't supposed to say that anyway, but. Yeah, can't remember either. But this psalmist is saying, show me, God. Show me your ways. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth. Teach me. Is this your heart cry? Do you hunger for God to teach you and to show you? I've got a couple of things here on the outline. Learning from those you don't think could possibly teach you anything. You can figure out pride's in there somewhere. I'm not sure where. Learning from those that are unlearned in your area of expertise. Let me give you an example of that. I'm a carpenter. I've built a number of houses for the last 30 years, 35 years. I know a little bit about building. Suppose I was on a job and trying to kind of figure out how I wanted to do the roof line and some rafters or the joists or whatever. I'm trying to kind of figure that out. And Susan drives up. And she just happens to drive by, so she stops and she comes up and she says, what are you doing? And I said, I'm trying to figure out how to do this. And she asked me, and she's done this before, asked me a question that requires a technical answer that I know she's not going to understand. But she asks the question, well, what if this time she comes up and she suggests, why don't you do this, this, this? You know what instantly goes through my mind? I'm smart enough not to say it, right? Okay? But I doubt if I'm good enough not to show it. Well, what I'm thinking is, why don't you go on? I'm trying to figure this out. And the implications are there is absolutely nothing you can do to help me. You can turn that around a little bit in the kitchen. You know, I've got a bad habit. Some of you have experienced my bad habit. I like to aggravate. I like to joke and to carry on. And you get to know someone a little bit and you kind of learn to know what buttons to push. And the challenge is to push it just enough to barely ruffle their feathers, but they won't get mad. All right? I've got a new daughter-in-law. And just this morning, I found myself doing this during practice, worship practice. She can play the violin. Y'all probably have noticed that. I don't know how to play violin. You know, once in a while, I'll tell her to oil that stick, you know, the bow. You know, they use terminology, you know, this. I'm trying to give her, it looks like I'm trying to give her advice, but I do it in such a way that it shows my own ignorance of the violin, right? Occasionally I'll say something in such a way and I'll try to find the fine line there where she doesn't really know I'm joking. She thinks I might actually be serious. And what I want to do is see the hackles come up just a little bit. And then send her home with Daniel. Can you learn? Can you be taught something from someone who is, quote, beneath you? Let me tell you kids something. This is not off the subject, but almost is. Here's five or six young kids right here. Probably every one of them, I could hand I've got a smartphone, which I didn't turn my volume down this morning. I know how to turn my volume down on my smartphone. Okay. Smartphone in a dumb guy's pocket. Okay. I could probably give this phone to any of those kids if I had trouble, and they could show me how to do what I wanted to do. They could do it so quick and so fast I wouldn't catch on. I wouldn't know how to do it 15 minutes later. Right? They can get on the internet on my phone, do anything they want to do. But I've been around the block more than they have. Y'all listen to me. I've been around the block a few times. Your skills in technology that we have today will far outpace or outgrow your wisdom to use it. If you don't really understand that, talk to your parents. Your ability to use this phone will grow a lot faster than your wisdom on how to use it. Can you be taught? You could show me how to use this phone, I could warn you about how not to use it. Number three, those who've been around the block knows that God does and/or does not. Remember, two sentences there, really, I'll separate them. Those who've been around the block know that God does remember. Those who've been around the block know that God does not remember. Let's look at verses 6 and 7. He says, remember, O Lord. Here's something the psalmist wants God to remember. God, you remember your tender mercies and your loving kindness. For they are from old. How does the psalmist know God's mercies and loving kindness are from old? Because he's experienced them. Because he's been around the block. He has seen them. He has felt them. God, remember those loving kindness and your mercy again today. Verse 7, do not remember, oh God, don't remember this. Don't remember the sins of my youth, nor my transgressions. This idea of remember here is not that God erases them from his memory. It's not that you go and ask God, God, you remember when I was a kid and I did this stupid thing? It's not that God says, no, I don't remember that. The idea is remembering them against you. Holding them against you. God, don't remember my transgressions against me. Number four, those who've been around the block know that the path is right, though their sins have been many. Let's read these verses. Verse 11, he says, good and upright is the Lord. Therefore he teaches sinners in the way. Now if you teach a sinner in the way, what's the result of that? The sinner is going in an unsinful path, right? Verse 9, the humble he guides in justice. Or he guides in just ways, equitable things, righteous ways. And the humble he teaches his way, the same idea. Verse 10, all of the paths of the Lord are mercy and truth to such as keep his covenant and his testimonies. For your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my iniquity, for it is great. I don't know if you've ever listened to Steve Brown. I haven't listened to him in years. I think he's still on the radio. If you ever get a chance to listen to him, I don't know what he's like now, but I used to, he's just like 15 minutes long on the radio, but he could say things in such a way that you remembered them. And I always remember his prayer, or part of it. I don't know if it's at the start of the program or I think it's at the end of the program, and he would be praying and say, Lord, forgive your servant's sins, for they are many. That stuck with me. It stuck with me not simply because mine are many also. They are. It stuck with me because the older you get, the more trips you've made around the block, the accumulative number of your sins grows. If I had a list of all my sins, there are new pages added frequently. The cumulative number of my sins are not getting less. They're getting more. I thought of money. And Don, you may help me out here, but I'll say this right. But it is said that the most powerful component of accumulating wealth is not the principal, or it's not the interest rate, it's time. Did I say that close to right? Time. Time brings accumulation, whether it's in the financial realm, it also brings accumulation in our sinful lives. The psalmist knows that. The psalmist acknowledges that. The psalmist is looking for God to guide him in righteous paths, not comfortable paths, not affluent paths, but righteous paths. Remember that. That should be the goal and the compelling component in your spiritual walk, that the paths you want to walk in are righteous paths. That is the priority. That is the criteria. Righteous paths. Knowing at the same time that we need pardon from our iniquities, because there are many. Let's go on. Number five. This is builds upon that point. Number five. Those who've been around the block know that right paths, there we go again, bring blessings. Right paths bring blessings. You're not looking for the blessings. Most people want the blessings, they don't give really a hoot about the righteous paths. They're after the blessings. And that's not the way it works. You walk in right paths, let God worry about the blessings. And those who've been around the block a few times will tell you that if you live your life following righteous paths, as a general rule, blessings come. They do. He says in these verses, they dwell in prosperity. They inherit the earth. It keeps your feet out of the net or out of the snare. As a general rule, when you walk in righteous paths, the result of walking in righteous paths and living wisely. Your feet are kept from the snares. You inherit the earth. You dwell in prosperity. How many times have I made decisions throughout my life that I knew better? I knew it wasn't wise. I knew it, but I was willing and wanting to take the risk. Or maybe I didn't even think about it. Especially in debt, finances. How many of us are quick to go into debt on a whim? When honestly, we would be hard-pressed to justify being able to pay off whatever it is we're going into. When Susan and I first got married, we didn't have anything. We didn't have any money, and we didn't have any stuff. We had a car that I kind of inherited, and it was 7 years old, 72 Dodge Coronet. We got married in 79, so it was 7 years old. Good cars in good shape. I was a builder or did carpenter work. Every tool I owned I could put in a toolbox. When we got married, my dad gave me a little wooden homemade toolbox with a few tools in it. And the toolbox was about as big as this pulpit, about that deep. And everything I owned I could put in there and put in the trunk of the car. That was my work truck. And that's where we started. We moved back to Heber Springs, and we didn't have a washer, we didn't have a dryer, we didn't have a refrigerator, a freezer, we didn't have anything. And every once in a while, you know, we'd say, man, we need to get a washer. Or we need this, we need that. And we'd go down to Rufo Martin Furniture. Every time we went there, we bought something. It wasn't but 4 or 5 times. But, you know, it was $10 we paid, bought a freezer, I think it's $200, $10 a month for 20 months. I was glad to get that paid off. $10. Washer, dryer, freezer, a little stereo cabinet that we needed like we needed a hole in our head. Every time they saw us coming, they knew we was fixing to sell something. Impulse debt. You ever done that? If we walk in righteous paths, it brings blessing. Number 6, those who've been around the block, and this keeps building on the same theme, those who've been around the block know that integrity and righteousness are an integral part of deliverance. Let's read 16 to 21 and notice what he says at the end. Verse 16, turn yourself to me and have mercy on me, for I am desolate, or I am alone, would be a word there, lonely. I'm desolate and afflicted. Verse 17, the troubles of my heart have enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses. Look on my affliction and my pain and forgive all my sins. Now notice something. Here is the psalmist who's been around. He's experienced God's fellowship. But yet, at this time, he's going through some tough times. There's something going on in his life that's unpleasant. And he's asking God for deliverance. He's telling God his circumstances. Verse 18, look on my affliction and my pain and forgive all my sins. Notice, look at 19. Consider my enemies, for they are many, and they hate me with cruel hatred. In David's life, when do you think this might have been? Probably when Saul was after, or perhaps when his son Absalom was after him. He had occasionally had different enemies. Verse 20, keep my soul and deliver me. Let me not be ashamed or again disappointed. Let me not be disappointed, for I put my trust in you. Now notice verse 21. Let integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. When you are in dire straits, and you will be, when hardships come, don't lose focus of the priority: integrity, uprightness. Don't, when those times come, when tough times come, don't yield to the temptation to exchange integrity for comfort, to exchange righteousness for deliverance. Retain your integrity and wait. The psalmist says he waits for God. Then very quickly, number 7. Those who've been around the block know their lives touch the world. Here the psalmist broadens his scope. He says, he has asked God to redeem him, to deliver him. Now he says, oh God, redeem Israel out of all their troubles. This psalmist, Psalm David, David's life affected not just David, but other people. And so does yours. So does mine. My response to troubles, my responses to life, doesn't just affect me. Who else does it affect? Susan, right? It affects Susan. You don't have to get very big to affect more than just Susan, does it? It affects her mom who lives with us. It will affect my mom who lives with us. It will affect you pretty quickly. It will affect those of you I'm closest to before it may affect some others in here. But it doesn't just touch me. My life doesn't. Neither does yours. Conrad, 12 or 13 years old, the decisions he makes in his life doesn't just touch him. Gives Kylie grief too, doesn't it, Kylie? All right, when I was a teenager, 18 or 19 years old, somehow I had this idea in my head that I know I'm doing bad stuff, but it's just me. I ain't hurt nobody but me. That's not right. It ain't. It touches someone else. You know, I don't know what you got from the psalm. The Lord will show you that. But I'll show you something I got. Is if we have a hunger for this, it's what we need. It's what you need, is a hunger for this. And I'm not talking about just read your little devotion so you feel good for that day. I'm talking about, do you really hunger? Or is it you're just going through the motions? I'm not saying don't do that. But if you're just reading the Bible every day, just and you read it and your mind is totally somewhere else. I mean, I know how that is. Your mind's somewhere else, but you read it and you got through and you checked the box. I read that for today. And there's really no hunger. That's not much different than picking up the crumbs that fall from the rich man's table. The satisfaction of discovery, the satisfaction of mining the ore, the precious gold, comes with work, comes with time. It comes with digging. And to do that consistently, there has to be desire, discipline. In my late 20s and early 30s, I went through probably a 4 or 5 year period where every night, almost, not every night, but almost every night, after me and Susan get the kids in bed and everything. From about 9 o'clock to about midnight, this is where I was at. It wasn't a chore. I was anxious to get there. It passed. Occasionally there's a spark. When you learn something, something grabs you. I want to challenge you. Find some way, somewhere, somehow to love this. I told you a few months ago when we first started the study and the teaching on through 2 Corinthians that I just kind of dreaded it because I just didn't enjoy that book. But I invested some time. I invested hours in that book. And I feel the fruit from it. It's rekindled that desire. Us going through the book on the pre-wrath rapture on Tuesday night has rekindled that fire. You need it. I need it. We all need it. Don't let years go by and be satisfied with eating crumbs. Let's pray. God, whatever love I have for you has been given to me by you. Whatever thirst I have for your word has been placed in my heart by your Spirit. God, I want it. I don't want to be driven by my flesh and occupy my time and my thoughts by things that are utterly worthless. God, I've given myself, I've given hours and hours over the years to things that in the end, what do they matter? Because they're not wrong. They just don't matter. God, give me that hunger. Give me that thirst. For righteousness, for justice, and the conviction that I find it in your word. Glorify yourself through my life and through the lives of these people. Lord, would you change us? Help us to grow deep in this place.